Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, May 28th. I'm Lisa Music reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, CAO says another tax increase needed in Humboldt County. Public opinion, tap for Great Redwood Trail environmental review, and grand jury blasts Family and Children's Services again. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. The state's budget deficit will likely impact local budgets, according to Alicia Hayes, Humboldt County CAO. The CAO office and Public Works are on a presentation tour explaining the importance of another sales tax or parcel tax, and they gave their presentation to the Eureka City Council last week. Kelly Lincoln brings us more.
The county's chief administrative office is on a tour to engage communities on the need for another tax to fund roads and to fund repairs from natural disasters. The county has a survey they are using to see what people want to have the money spent on, county roads or climate mitigation, emergency communication or homeless services. Alicia Hayes, the county CAO, and Tom Madsen, director of county public works, gave a presentation to the Eureka City Council Tuesday, May 21st, calling attention to the need for a tax increase and to the survey. Madsen noted the increasing rate of natural disasters over the course of his career.
When I started with the county in 1998, looking back over 20 years, we were getting a declared disaster on average every 3 years. We've had four in the last since 2022, one earthquake and three storm damages. In 2017, we got hit with over $40 million in damage to our road system, another $15 million in 2019, and another about $15 million in the four disasters since 2022. This impacts the response times that our first responders have getting out to communities. This winter in Redwood Valley was shut off for nearly 2 weeks, basically getting back and forth on ATVs.
CAO Hayes was direct. The county needs to find a way to tax its citizens.
By its nature, an emergency declaration is a statement saying that the government doesn't have the resources to adequately address the emergency. We don't want to hide the ball with this group or any other. A potential solution that we are looking into are potential tax measures. A local tax measure, whether it's a sales tax, a parcel tax, or some other revenue-generating mechanism.
Hayes explains that the state budget deficit threatens to encroach further on local budgets.
Over the last 30 years, the state has taken over $500 million away from local governments to fulfill its own obligations. And most recently, it's amounted to $25 million a year. And that number continues to climb. And as we have all probably seen, we know that they are looking at significant cuts to local jurisdictions in emergency preparedness and transportation funding.
She goes on to say,
the fact of the matter is that disasters are the new normal in Humboldt County, and we need to adjust to that new reality.
The county's survey focuses on roads, existing 911 services, and disaster communication for first responders, not on the OES shortcomings addressed in the 2023 grand jury report. However, Hayes explains,
when it comes to county government, we have felt the impacts of the disasters most on our roads, which affects residents' abilities to evacuate and our ability to come into the communities who need us to help them. We simply live in an area where the impacts from disasters significantly affect our roads compared to other infrastructures. This slide mentions hardening and upgrading of our roads, and in that regard, it's important to know that reimbursements from the state and federal governments are not the silver bullet.
Madsen noted that FEMA reimbursements are not efficient.
And then on the federal reimbursement process. When FEMA comes out and says we are providing X billion dollars for this disaster, they are actually not providing X billion dollars for that disaster. 90% of that money that they come out with is going to pay agencies across the nation for former disasters. So on average, it takes us 6 to 10 years to get full reimbursement on our projects.
Mattson went on to discuss PCI, Pavement Condition Index. This rates current road conditions, and the poorer the score, the higher ongoing maintenance costs become.
So looking at our pavement analysis, to have a good pavement system, you need a PCI of 70. And why you want that is that's where you minimize your operational maintenance costs, because your road system is in decent shape, and it's cheaper to maintain a road in good shape than it is to rebuild a road in bad shape. So if we were going to be in a perfect world, we would need to come up with $500 million over 10 years to get that PCI to 70. And every time we delay maintenance, it increases the cost.
Mattson and Hayes told the Eureka City Council that the California counties that have roads with an index rating over 70 all have self-taxing measures in place. Mattson said they usually have more than one such revenue source in place. There is a survey that Humboldt County residents can take to tell the county what their spending priorities are. And on that survey, community groups can invite the CAO office to give their presentation in person. Finding the survey without a QR code is not straightforward. But if you persevere, you can go to Humboldt County's website and search for Newsflash. The results return in random order, but there it will offer an advanced search function. Use that to search for Disaster Priorities Survey, and the survey will be listed in the returns. This is Kelly Lincoln reporting for KMUD News.
Public commenters have weighed in on what the scope of an environmental review of the Great Redwood Trail should be. Daniel Mintz reports.
The environmental review process for the Great Redwood Trail has taken its first steps with a public comment scoping session. Held May 14th, the online event fielded a first volley of public comments on the trail project's potential impacts and what should be done to address them. The comments will shape a draft version of a programmatic environmental impact report covering the 231-mile trail project running through Mendocino, Trinity, and Humboldt counties. That document is expected to be released for public review by the end of this year. The trail will be developed within the former North Coast Railroad Authority right-of-way, and Scott Greason, the conservation director for Friends of the Eel River, noted the impacts of rail wreckage that lingers.
Part of what needs to be remediated are the significant amounts of metal and other debris on the bank and in the river itself, which are, I was reminded this past weekend, often a hazard to navigation. Life and limb, and are going to be a significant challenge, obviously, in terms of figuring out where they are and how to remove them. But I think it's pretty clear that that whole aspect of the sort of railroad aftermath and the need for mitigation was part of the 99 consent decree that is part of the history of the NCRA and thus part of the GRTA's ambit and responsibility ultimately. So I think it's important that be included in the scope of the project.
Michelle Merrifield, a member of the Round Valley Tribe, said the trail path and the abandoned rail infrastructure runs through important cultural areas and needs to be cleaned up.
My interest in here on this railroad is that it goes through an area for our ancestral village sites in the Eel River Canyon, which caused some damage back when that railroad went through. So I'm opposed to the trail going through there. When I first heard about this, I was opposed to this trail going through at all. I don't like it at all. One, because the abandoned railroad track has been left there for over 50 years, has not been taken care of. It's an eyesore. It's a scar on Mother Nature. And nobody wants to clean it up. And now the GRTA wants to clean it up, but they don't say where, when, and how much of this railroad track is going to be cleaned up.
Patty Clary of Californians for Alternatives to Toxics said there's potential creosote leaching and the presence of, quote, many other chemicals in polluted areas, including dioxin and pesticides. She said the polluted sites in the trail areas need to be identified because trail development and use could release their toxins.
We'd like to see every known toxic site and every potentially toxic site and how they're going to be dealt with. And we want to see that in the PEIR because we're afraid when it gets out into the smaller field parts that we'll lose the intensity of focus that's needed. We've seen on most of the trail parts that have already been put in that there's been virtually no study of what happened, historical context. Was there a sawmill along that part of the rail line which used pentachlorophenol, you know, et cetera? This is, really has not been happening. So that's got to stop. And because releasing these contaminants back into the environment through construction and use is going to add another catastrophe to the various waterways that could be impacted all along the line.
The project's components and goals were outlined. The trail aims to provide a, quote, world-class recreational experience with a mix of paved, gravel, and backcountry segments accommodating wheelchair users, hikers, bicyclists, equestrians, rafters, and others. It will link to public lands and parks and add to, quote, green infrastructure and sustainable transportation networks. The cleanup of rail waste and, quote, environmental restoration are listed among its goals. The public scoping comment period is open until May 31st. The release of the draft PEIR will open a 45-day comment period. Clary asked that it be expanded to 3 months, and a final EIR is expected to be released in the spring or summer of 2025. For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Turning to Mendocino, the grand jury has come out with its first report of the season, titled, quote, "The Broken Process at Family and Children's Services," end quote. KZYX's Sarah Reith brings you the details.
The grand jury has come out with its first report of the season, titled, "The Broken Process at Family and Children's Services." The report is largely a review of many previous grand jury reports about Family and Children's Services, highlighting low staffing, stagnant recruitment, and the resulting overwork of existing staff who are unable to meet their obligations. The report focuses on the emotional damage inflicted on children and families when their cases drag on indefinitely, as well as the high levels of stress experienced by social workers who can't complete their tasks in a timely manner. The short work week also came in for plenty of criticism, with the grand jury recommending that offices be open on Fridays. And it highlights large percentages of Native American children receiving the services of a system characterized as broken. The stakes are high. According to the California Department of Public Health Center for Healthy Communities, high levels of stress and trauma during childhood, known as adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, can have lifelong effects on physical and mental health and financial well-being. The grand jury declares that children and families entering the court system and trying to wend their way through the maze of lawyers, social workers, judges, etc., are experiencing toxic stress on top of the ACEs that have been complicating their existence. There have been 6 reports about children's services since 1999, including one last year that noted low staffing and overwork among social workers. Another of last year's reports took a close look at the county's human resources practices overall. That one recommended creating an ombudsman position, defined as an independent and impartial official who serves as a mediator or advocate to resolve conflicts and address concerns within an organization, ensuring fairness and protecting individuals' rights. The ombudsman program for children has not been implemented, and the county does have an ombudsman for aging and adult services. The racial disparities at Family and Children's Services are a grave concern. Using the county's case management and child welfare data, the report cites that, though 6.6% of the county's population is Native American, 29.2% of the children placed in emergency transitional care are Native. Native children comprise 19% of Family and Children's Services court cases and 24% of the children in foster care in Mendocino County. The report recommends that the department improve relations and communication with representatives of the Indian Child Welfare Act, which regulates the placement of Native children due to a long history of unnecessary removals and outright abductions. This year's investigation was sparked in part by complaints about late court reports, which leave children and families in the limbo of temporary placements and delayed court proceedings. Among the definitions for terms that the report relies on heavily are moral injury, which occurs when social workers are unable to effectively address the difficulties they're tasked with solving, and burnout, defined as a state of physical or emotional exhaustion that also involves a sense of reduced accomplishment and loss of personal identity. Family and Children's Services has a 29.3% vacancy rate, and in February of last year, a staff of 58 worked 507 hours of overtime. High levels of overtime were also noted in a report from 10 years ago. The department also suffers from a misalignment of skills. The county has a waiver that allows it to hire staff who do not have degrees in social work, but there's also a shortage of lower-level workers who can do things like drive children around. This leads to more highly qualified staff performing comparatively unskilled tasks. Employees who were interviewed for the investigation characterized the work culture as toxic, with high rates of absenteeism due to stress, medical leave, and high turnover. According to the report, the FCS approach to hiring social workers was described as churn them out and burn them out. Staffing needs are addressed by allowing and encouraging overtime for current workers rather than hiring additional staff. In many cases, hiring for job positions is on hold. Family and Children's Services offices are closed on Fridays, which means that anything that comes up at the end of the week is delayed until Monday. The report notes that if one workday is removed from each week, in 1 month, 1 week will have been lost, denying the public access to the department's services for those days. The grand jury recommended staggering employees' schedules so that some social workers are available on Fridays. By far, the greatest obstacle is a shortage of staff. This is caused by comparatively low salaries and a recruitment process where applicants can wait up to 6 months from the time of application to their hiring date. This was also noted in a report from the 2012-2013 season. The grand jury also learned that local social workers provide services to children who come from Mendocino County but are placed in adjacent counties. The social workers' monthly visits sometimes take them away from the office for 2 days at a time. When they get back, they're expected to catch up on all the work they missed while they were gone, which contributes to late reports and missed deadlines. The grand jury asserts that there are no consequences for missing deadlines and no incentives for meeting them. There's also no quality assurance office at the department, though a system improvement plan is supposedly going through an approval process. The grand jury believes that based on outcomes in other counties, a monthly quality assurance review would improve the performance of the local department. The grand jury believes that the county can afford to properly staff the department, though this year's report notes that it is difficult to decipher the FCS budget. Lack of specific line items causes lack of transparency and understanding of how the money is used. Returning to the topic of delayed reports and extended court proceedings, the grand jury warned that when FCS fails to meet legally mandated timelines for the filing of court reports, they are not providing the children and families with due process, possibly creating a civil rights violation liability for Mendocino County. The 23 recommendations range from hiring more staff and increasing salaries to offering training on a statewide computer system. The grand jury expects the majority of its recommendations to be implemented by October of this year. For KZYX News, I'm Sarah Wright.
In Headline Mendocino, KMUD's Matt LaFever brings the latest from Mendocino County, where prescribed burns are reducing fire risk in a state forest. A hit-and-run driver was sentenced to state prison, and a NorCal reggae band released their fourth album.
This is Matt LaFever with the headlines out of Mendocino County for Tuesday, May 28, 2024. Let's begin with an important announcement from CAL FIRE Mendocino Unit about a prescribed burn in our area. Starting yesterday, Monday, May 27th, through this Friday, May 31st, CAL FIRE will be conducting a vegetation management prescribed burn on the Jackson Demonstration State Forest. This burn aims to treat approximately 100 acres of timber slash and timber understory from the Red Tail Timber Harvest Plan. Jackson Demonstration State Forest is situated along State Highway 20 between the towns of Willits and Fort Bragg. The burn will begin each day around 10 a.m. and conclude by 3 p.m. Prescribed burns are a critical part of California's strategy to reduce wildfire risk and improve forest health. This controlled burn will create a mosaic of burned and unburned areas, enhancing the forest ecosystem and helping to prevent larger, uncontrolled wildfires in the future. Residents in the area may notice smoke and see aircraft overhead during the burn operations. CAL FIRE assures the public that the burn will be conducted under strictly controlled weather and fuel conditions to ensure safety and effectiveness. To learn more about the ongoing efforts to reduce wildfire risk across California, you can visit the CAL FIRE Fuels Reduction Dashboard at fire.ca.gov. For those of you wondering how to prepare your own homes and families for wildfire season, useful tips and resources are available at readyforwildfire.org. Now let's turn to the Mendocino County Superior Court, where last week, 31-year-old Juan Jose Naranjo Rodriguez of Ukiah admitted to his crimes and agreed to a state prison sentence. Juan Naranjo Rodriguez, who was on probation for a prior DUI conviction, was driving on a suspended license in March of 2024 when he once again drove under the influence of alcohol. His blood alcohol levels were alarmingly high, recorded at 0.20 and 0.19. While driving on State Street and turning east on a Talmadge Road, Rodriguez claimed distraction led him to hit a pedestrian. Rather than stopping to help, he fled the scene, later admitting to investigators that he feared getting into more trouble. Good Samaritans rushed to aid the badly injured woman, providing crucial assistance until medical professionals arrived. The victim, who sustained severe injuries, including broken legs, a broken pelvis, loss of hearing, and knocked out teeth, remains in leg braces and wheelchair-bound, hoping for a full recovery after multiple surgeries. Rodriguez, still driving his damaged Nissan Versa, was spotted by the California Highway Patrol near Kohl's department store. He was then arrested by the Ukiah Police Department shortly thereafter. Last week, with the help of his counsel and an interpreter, Rodriguez changed his not guilty pleas to no contest. He admitted to felony hit and run, driving causing injury, and feloniously driving a motor vehicle with a blood alcohol level of 0.08 or greater, causing injury. He also admitted to inflicting great bodily injury on the victim, categorizing this as a violent felony case. To avoid a trial, Rodriguez agreed to a state prison sentence of 60 months. Given the violent nature of his crime, he will only be eligible for early release credits up to 15% of his sentence. This conviction will also count as a future strike if he is convicted of another felony. With the victim and her family present, Mendocino County Superior Court Judge Victoria Shanahan accepted Rodriguez's plea on Thursday afternoon. The final sentencing will take place on July 3, 2024 at 9 a.m. in Department B of the Ukiah Courthouse. And now for exciting news from Hopland. Northern California's acclaimed reggae band Top Shelf is set to release their highly anticipated fourth studio album, New Kind of World, on June 7th. To celebrate, they're hosting a special release event in Hopland at the picturesque Gateway Mendocino's Reggae on the Pond. Top Shelf's new record, New Kind of World, features collaborations with some of Jamaica's top reggae artists and will be available worldwide across all major streaming platforms. Top Shelf describes their album as more than just music, but a journey through the soul of reggae, promising an immersive experience from start to finish. The album release event at Gateway Mendocino's Reggae on the Pond is not to be missed. Nestled in the heart of Hopland, the venue offers a beautiful setting for a night of live music and celebrations. With tickets at $20, available now at Eventbrite, gates will be open at 4 p.m. with music starting at 5. And that's the latest from Mendocino County. I'm Matt Lefevre in Hopland, reporting for KMUD News.
A person traveling through Humboldt County on May 9th and 10th was confirmed to have contracted measles. The Humboldt County Department of Health has now identified 115 people that were exposed to the infected person, both at Days Inn on 5th Street in Eureka from 2 p.m. on May 9th to 3 a.m. on May 10th, as well as at the Providence St. Joseph Hospital emergency room on Friday, May 10th from 2:30 a.m. to 6:30 a.m. As county health officials continue monitoring the exposed individuals, anyone not yet contacted by DHHS who was at the two locations at the previously mentioned times should contact the Humboldt County Department of Health and Human Services. During a virtual press conference with local media, the county's health officer, Dr. Candy Stockton, shared the latest update in the contact tracing from the exposure.
Sure. So I can say that as of an hour ago, we located the 115th individual. So we have actually managed to contact trace every single individual that we're aware of that was potentially exposed.
Though none of the exposed individuals have exhibited any symptoms of the measles virus, they are not quite out of the woods yet.
At this point, none of them have contracted measles. We are still in the potential window period for developing measles until about 6:30 a.m. on the 31st of this month.
The likelihood of a surge in cases from the recent exposure is low. However, Dr. Stockton is wary of making that declaration just yet.
The likelihood is very low. Again, we're very fortunate that most of those individuals who were exposed were over the age of 30, which is before a lot of the anti-MMR vaccine misinformation that's circulating really started to come into play. So the vast majority of individuals were actually vaccinated. Had this happened in a school setting or a place where there are a lot of young individuals, that might have been very different.
As the county's health officer, Dr. Stockton stated she is concerned with dropping vaccination rates.
As unrelated to this outbreak, public health is always concerned about lowering rates of vaccination. And in fact, in the year 2000, we considered that measles had essentially been eradicated in the U.S., meaning that any cases that we did see were sporadic cases that were brought back when they were obtained from travel abroad. When your vaccination rates start to drop, those diseases start to show up again. And so we're always concerned about lower vaccination rates.
Many symptoms of measles mimic common illnesses such as cough, stuffy nose, or conjunctivitis. However, Dr. Stockton shared signs to look for and protocol to follow if a person believes they have measles.
So in general, measles is going to be the least likely cause of any cough, stuffy nose, runny nose, pink eye, conjunctivitis type of thing that you might see. That we wouldn't recommend that you start seeing or thinking measles when that happens, unless you've had a known exposure or you've traveled outside the country to somewhere where there's current cases. So we would not recommend that everybody who develops that in the next few days, you know, immediately rush into their doctor. However, the rash for measles is. Or measles tends to present as a low-grade fever, cough and cold symptoms, and then a couple days later as a rash, which usually, but not always, starts at the top and works its way down. It tends to be a red polka-dotted rash, although in people with a little bit darker skin color, that can be less obviously red. But that combination of factors, those cold symptoms followed by a unique rash developing, if you were to have that, there are still dozens of other viruses that can cause something similar to that. But at that point, you should call and check in with your healthcare provider to go through some questions over the phone to see if you might be higher risk and should be tested for measles or some other illness. And if you don't have a healthcare provider, then you should call public health. And that number is, for our communicable disease who's watching for this over the next several weeks, is 707-268-2181. And that will take you to somebody who can screen you. We ask that if you are developing symptoms that you think might be measles, please do not go into a healthcare facility unless you are so sick you need immediate medical support, because we don't want to risk that spreading to other individuals, particularly in a healthcare setting, other individuals who might be immunocompromised and may not be able to fight off the virus if they are exposed to it.
If you believe you were exposed to measles, please contact the Department of Health and Human Services at 707-268-2182. That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips. And thanks to our reporters, Kelly Lincoln, Daniel Mintz, Sarah Reith, and Matt LaFever. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Music.